1, 2, 3. There's a well-known exception, or maybe it isn't exception, to the foreseeable plaintiff rule, and that's the rescuer rule, right? And so casebooks love it because it's also a Cardozo decision. This is where the guy goes to rescue his cousin, remember, and he's injured. And what Cardozo says is that danger invites rescue. Rescuers are always foreseeable. So some people think he's contradicting himself, right? Because he said the plaintiff has to be foreseeable, and then he says rescuers are foreseeable whether the defendant foresaw them or not. They're liable even if they don't foresee them. So some people think it contradicts Holzgraf. Other authorities go, no, he's simply saying that, hey, anytime there's danger, a reasonable person will foresee rescuers. Therefore, rescues are foreseeable. So it's simply an illustration of his general point. Whatever it is, you frequently see this rescuer rule listed as an exceptional qualification of Holzgraf. Everybody go with the big picture. Okay, so we're starting to put some kind of framework, and I want you to realize that we're forcing framework, right? As you will have realized reading for today, courts will do whatever framework they want. And this is an area where you see very different approaches in different jurisdictions. So we're kind of forcing a framework that makes sense while acknowledging that courts will conduct this inquiry however they want. Good? Okay, so what I really want to focus on today is this third concept of an intervening actor. And I'm hoping that the first set of clicker questions is simply a terminology hypo sheet to make sure we all use the words in the same way, because I'm willing to bet that superseding was not something you said before you read for this class, right? It's not something you, now you can use it all the time, but let's just make sure we're all using it together. So you're looking at the front of the hypo sheet, page 1, terminology and hypo sheet. So construction company fails to barricade a large hole it excavated. So here's the defendant, construction company, and they fail to barricade the large hole. That's their breach, right? They dig a hole and there's no barricade, okay? Oh, okay. Then defendant Jack comes driving along and his breach is he changed lanes without looking, right? Which only happens 50% of the time on 270, okay? And he sideswipes plaintiff's car, causing plaintiff to crash, and they actually crash into the hole, and they're injured. Okay, so if you look at the first thing I told you to do, it was to do a diagram. Why is it so important to diagram when you're looking for intervening causes? Because the you're looking at the causal chain, and how does the causal chain develop? What kind of line is that on the board? It's a
linear temporal line.
Linear temporal is what some people call it. Most people say it's a timeline. No, timeline. It's a timeline. Linear temporal. Timeline. Everybody see it? When you're looking for intervening, you're always looking at a timeline, right? You're always going to have one defendant, then a little later there's another defendant, and then plaintiff is very unhappy, right? So intervening always is looking at some kind of timeline. And if you don't draw your timeline, you're going to have the people in the wrong place with the wrong label. So let's do a little review of our sheet. Actual cause, remember that? Oh no, that was weeks ago, we forgot that. Okay, yes or no? Is Jack, right here, an actual cause of plaintiff's injury? Yes or no? You only have like 20 seconds. Because it's easy and it's review. There is, 26 of you, all I care about. I'm ruthless today. Okay, yes, 25 out of 26, right? But for Jack, plaintiff would suffer no injury. Okay, and let's do the same thing with the construction company. Is the construction company a but-for cause of plaintiff's injury?
Yes.
25 if you're all I care about. Slight lesser percentage, but the answer is yes, right? But for the construction company, he could have safely swerved or something. Maybe he would have recovered driving, but instead he crashes into the hole. So they are both cause and facts of plaintiff's injury. They're actually multiple what? Anyone remember? Multiple. I heard it. Multiple necessary causes, because you need both of them to get plaintiff bloody at the end of the hole, right? So they're multiple necessary causes. Okay, now we have to ask the inquiry proximate cause. So what do you think? Is Jack the proximate cause of plaintiff's injury? Yes or no? Yes. So let's do our two inquiries. Why is plaintiff foreseeable? Because?
He's driving on the highway.
Right. And what? And defendant's breach was to change lanes without signaling, right? Change lanes without looking. That means the foreseeable plaintiffs are at a minimum the other drivers. What kind of harm do you foresee when you change lane without looking? You actually hit someone, or that's not what actually happened. They are harmed when they try and swerve out the way and deal with your moving into their lane. So notice it's an easy proximate cause against Jack. Right? There is no question that what occurred to the plaintiff is the type of harm we would expect given the defendant's breach. Okay, so the next question is, what argument will construction company try and raise to defeat its liability? So what argument, what type of argument do you predict the construction company is going to raise to try and defeat liability back to it? That the plaintiff suffered the wrong type of harm, that the risk they created was over or superseding cause? Right. Why can't they argue the wrong type of harm? What was their breach?
Not covering the
hole. What type of harm do you foresee? Bingo! It's the perfect type of harm. What's the risk over? It wouldn't be over until they covered the hole or put up a barricade. So the risk definitely wasn't over. So the only argument they have to escape liability is that somehow Jack's activities are classified as superseding and cut off responsibility to them. Everybody see? We're good? Okay, so we need some basic sentences we could utter. Like, what is an intervening act? So that's the first word we have to deal with. What is an intervening act? So look right on the board and tell me what you would call, what is the intervening act? What is it? This is it. So how would you define an intervening act? Don't get all technical, just make sure you can define it. So an intervening act is something that happens between defendant's breach and plaintiff's injury. Right? That's why it intervenes. See it? So an intervening act simply means something happens between defendant's breach and plaintiff's injury. Now notice, intervening is a sort of neutral descriptive term. It doesn't tell us a result, right? It just tells us something happened, right? Got it? Start waving if we're not happy. Okay, what's the intervening act here? Oh, Jack's driving. Okay, what label do we apply to the intervening act if we decide it functions to block attribution to the earlier tortfeasor. So if we're going to say this breaks the chain, you can't get back to this defendant, what label do we add to this event? Anyone? Superseding. So we call it a superseding intervening. Because we like big words because we're lawyers. Okay? So notice superseding is the label we're going to attach if we reach the conclusion that it breaks the causational chain. So courts often say the superseding clause breaks the causational chain. Sometimes you'll other parenthesis. Sometimes courts call it the efficient intervening. I don't know why. So you'll just see that in some cases or some outlines. They'll call it an efficient intervening, same meaning as superseding. Okay. Are we good? Wave. Ask. Okay. The next question I asked you is, who's going to argue that an intervening act was superseding? One, the plaintiff. Two, the defendant. So when you're looking at that issue, who is it who's going to say, oh my goodness, it was superseding? Is it going to be the plaintiff who argues that an intervening act was superseding, or is it the defendant? Okay? So plaintiff or the defendant. We in? 100% of you. Excellent.
Can we
you can.
We're all in the same
pot. What?
We're all thinking cookies, right?
Yeah.
Oh, you're all...
We're like rats in a maze.
You are. You know, once I described the first year law students are like rats in a maze, and I felt really bad. But if you self-describe, that's your problem. Okay. Okay. So, yeah, look, you're at 91%. Okay. So you can predict, right, what's going to happen. This defendant is going to try and label Jack's conduct as superseding. Okay. Why? So this is the last question, which I think isn't quite as clearly explained in the introductory material, which is what we've been reviewing. What's the effect if we label Jack's conduct as superseding? So if we label Jack's conduct as superseding, who's liable? Jack only? Both of them? Neither. So if Jack's conduct picks up the label superseding, who's liable to the plaintiff? Both Jack and Construction Company? B, Jack only? C, neither. Still doing pretty good. Excellent, right? Jack only, because it cuts the chain and you can't prove that the construction company was the proximate cause, there's that little label, of the plaintiff's injury, because we choose to cut off liability. Okay, let's try the second scenario. If Jack's act is not superseding, okay, so if we decide to label Jack's conduct as not superseding, who's liable? A, both Jack and construction company, B, Jack only, C, neither. Oh, there's 30 of you now? Mm-hmm. Both of them. Okay. So, why is it, what fact pattern is it where you're going to see a lot of argument as to how to characterize Jack's conduct? So when are cases going to really turn on superseding? I don't know. Look at the little note I asked you. When?
When you can't find Jack.
Bingo! You can't find Jack, right? That's because they're like, oh, it's all Jack's fault, not us. Go find Jack. Can't find Jack. Oh, I'm sorry, never mind. Right? So, do you see, if the plaintiff can find Jack, and Jack is actually very wealthy, plaintiff's not going to make the fight about this defendant, right? They're going to go, thank you, Jack. Give me my money. Bye. So all these cases, either there's a personal reason for not suing this middle person, right? There's some decision that's involved in not suing this person, so they want to leap back, or Jack has disappeared. But there's some reason why they're not going after the intervening actor. See it? Yeah.
All right. I had a question about this earlier. If Jack settles out of court with the plaintiff for, say, 25% of what would have been owed, is plaintiff still able to recover 100% from the construction company?
Plaintiff can never recover more than the total amount of their interest. So no plaintiff can ever recover more than the total amount of their interest.
Settled out
doesn't
of court.
Matter.
Okay.
How we allocate between two defendants is an appropriation rule, and we'll come back to that later, right? Because we've already seen the problem with multiple defendants. So different courts will allocate different ways. Different courts do different things with settlement. So we'll get to that, okay? Are we happy? Good, because the only thing we have to work out is when would an intervening act be superseding, and we're done, right? We know why we label it. We know what happens when we label it. But our problem is to figure out when something's superseding. And the reading was just so clear. It's amazing, right? You were like, yep, I got it. Okay, you ready to bravely go where no man has ever gone, where law students go every year with pain. You good? Okay, so first let's try the little note cases of Pollard and Clark, 336 to 337. Now, all right, see them, 336 to 337. Okay, I need my timeline. So let's do Pollard first. Okay, I need my little people, and I want to fill my little people in, okay? So who are the people involved in Pollard? Who's the first negligent actor? Yes, Ms. Evans.
The railroad company.
The railroad, and how do they breach?
They left containers with residual blasting powder out.
They leave blasting powder lying around. Okay, and let's zoom all the way to the unhappy plaintiff. Who's the plaintiff? How are they injured?
It's Pollard, who is a friend of Millard, who was the one that had collected. And they lit it and he got hurt in the explosion.
Okay, and because the case is in this section, yeah, no, someone else is doing something. So what is the intervening act or actor?
Millard, and he was the boy that collected it and put it all together.
Right? And then they go and play.
Yeah.
Okay. Does the court hold that Millard's conduct is clearly intervening? Everybody see it intervenes between the railroad's negligence and the plaintiff's injury. Does the court hold it superseding or not?
Superseding. Break the chain. No liability going back to the railroad.
Okay, I understand how it works. Okay, let's do the next case. Okay, the next case is the Clark case. Okay, so what does Clark look like? Anyone give me Clark? Someone else give me Clark. Yes.
Explosive manufacturer had they left on a farm and thing with glycerin.
Oh, so they leave explosives lying around? Okay. Okay, and how's plaintiff injured?
Finds the explosives buried in a graveyard that McDowell left.
Okay, so they're injured when they play with the explosives. Okay, there has to be an intervening event.
Master, this is not superseding. It is superseding. Wait, it has to match.
Is it superseding or not? Wait, the same fat pen, right? Leaves an explosion, boy messes, injured an explosion. So this one must be superseding too.
It's not. They said it didn't break the call chain.
Okay, I'm confused. Aresia, slight problem. So, what's the difference? Why is it that the court treats Millard, who collects the powder, right, into his little buckets, hides them out back, and then goes and plays with them, versus McDowell, who takes the explosives and hides it? Why is one intervening and one isn't? Yes?
It's the amount of intervening action. When Millard took it, it wasn't in an inherently dangerous state as it was. He had to actually work to bring it together. He was told by his parents, no, get rid of it or I'm going to beat you. It was not actually dangerous. It was not a great danger in its found state. If you just lit it, it would smoke and it would sputter and it would spark, but it wouldn't cause a big explosion. Whereas the glycerin that was left in a big block, you don't have to do anything to it. You could have just been digging, hit it, and caused it to explode because it's that volatile.
Okay, so do you guys agree or disagree? You actually said a couple of things. So do people agree or disagree? Yeah?
I kind of saw their reasoning because they said that Millard created a whole new power of, I think, like a mischief or something. So he created something, didn't just take exactly what he was given, and it created an explosion. Whereas they said that the glycerin, it was in a volatile state no matter what. It was just a matter of time.
So instead of mischief, what might we modern 20th century people say? Foreseeable than this one, right? Why do you think McDowell finding it is much more foreseeable than what Millard does?
Because
So you said because it's on the farm, more people are going to mess with it.
And it takes less effort. Is it similar to what we're saying? It takes less effort to make it dangerous.
It's less effort. So how would you characterize what McDowell did? Smart, stupid, reckless, negligent, intentional. What do you think? What? McDowell?
Oh.
Little McDowell, what did he do?
Teddy
Barry. So what do you think? Stupid? Brilliant?
He's trying to use it already. He's trying something different.
He's trying! Is it the best idea you've ever heard of?
No.
No! It's kind of stupid, right? But he's not, you know. Okay. How about Millard? How would you characterize what Millard does? He said,
reckless.
See the different quality of the conduct. Could you go even farther than reckless? I think stupid is less. So if you think, okay, so this is Gillis's Guide to Life. Okay, so you're thinking about people you see around you. How likely is it that they'll do something stupid? Highly likely. There they are. I do at least six things a day that are stupid. If you ask my 15-year-old, it's probably 600 stupid things that I do every day, right? Stupid is up there. What's down the middle? What's at the bottom? So what do you expect to happen less?
Really smart things.
Oh, really smart things. Okay. Really smart things she'll put right at the bottom. Okay, but we're not really worried about really smart things because usually they don't cause harm. They don't cause harm, right? If you've done a really smart thing, I'll put it in a container, I'll call the company and make them pick it up, we wouldn't have a problem. So we never are dealing with people who've made the best choice, right? Negligence is always, oops, bad choice, right? Or oops, shouldn't have done that. Okay, so what other conduct do we have? Yep.
He's adding on to what was positionally put there.
So, do you think he was, so you think Millard was stupid, or you think it's stronger? He wants to put, right down here, like intentional, reckless. What about in the middle? Careless, which is, in legal terms, negligent. So sometimes people are negligent, right? A lot of the time they're stupid, we kind of expect people to make bad decisions. Some of the time we're like, yeah, people don't really take reasonable care. Sometimes they're reckless or intentional. And sometimes what's the worst you could say about their behavior, it's actually a... I don't know, we'll just leave it filling in later, okay? So, what is more foreseeable? Bingo! So one way to look at the intervening act, right, is to look at it on this scale, right? We expect people to be stupid or maybe even negligent. That's a foreseeable intervening act. But when we get right down here and talk about people who are reckless or intentionally cause harm, we're going to say, no, that you don't have to foresee that. That's unforeseeable. So another way of distinguishing the two boys is that McDowell was maybe stupid, right? It wasn't the best idea of what to do with the glycerin. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't the best. Whereas Millard, right, seems to recklessly or intentionally go ahead and create a new risk. So see, that's the other way courts sometimes talk about superseding, right? They talk about whether the intervening act itself was foreseeable given the breach. Are we waving at me? Yes. I think it's stronger than malicious. It's someone else's world. Criminal. You shouldn't have to think about crime, right? We think crime is atypical, unforeseeable. Most of the time, that's how we would rate the likelihood. So, let us
flip the page. Oh, look! It's a useful little chart! Yeah?
So, before, the applies to hypo, presuming that Jack just speeds away and then he is never identified, what should we write for that?
What should you write for that? So that's the type of case where you're likely to see what? So if Jack goes away, what type of case, what are you likely to see as an argument? Okay, well, what's the plaintiff want? And if Jack's gone, who's the plaintiff likely to sue? There you go. So the type of cases you're likely to see a superseding cause argument in is where that middle person has disappeared, right? Does that make sense? So how's the hypo going to come out? The hypo's going to come out that that's exactly the type of case where the plaintiff's going to have to fight superseding because they've got to get back to that original wrongdoer. So see it? Okay, if we flip the page. Okay. There are two ways to approach proximate cause. Well, at least two ways. Probably 50. Okay. One way is to understand common law presumptions. In other words, what courts typically end up saying, right? Now, this is a test we can run. It just enables us to predict what the court's going to happen. So, in other words, if I was a betting woman, I'd be betting on X. You still have to do all the analysis, but you at least know who you think's going to win, right? So that's much easier than doing the analysis when you have no idea. So everybody see the first set of rules we're looking at? We're looking at what the common law typically finds or presumes. So let's try the first one. Criminal acts and intentional wrongdoing are presumptively superseding, not superseding, or there is no presumption at all. So what do you think? When we look at an intervening act that's an intentional or criminal wrongdoing, what kind of presumption is the court going to have about whether it's superseding or not? Superseding, right? They're going to say, oh my goodness, no one would have expected the Spanish Inquisition. No, they would have expected a criminal or intentional act, right? So they're going to tend to say it's superseding. We're going to have to do work, and it's not an absolute rule, but we at least know what the court's inclination is going to be. How about negligent activity? Negligent acts are presumptively superseding, presumptively not superseding, or there's no presumption. No presumption. Our cookies. Okay, so most courts will simply assess in those cases whether the defendant's breach makes the intervening act foreseeable. So they won't say, oh my goodness, you were negligent, it's automatically superseding. Let's try the last one. Medical malpractice in treating the injury is presumptively A, superseding, B, not superseding. No presumption.
B, not superseding, is the correct answer. Okay, now, just pause for a minute, those of you who have medical professionals within your life. What's the fact pattern? Let's make sure we see the medical malpractice fact pattern. What happens? So where's the doctor? There's the doctor. So let's just go, here we have a drunk driver, okay? And what's plaintiff's injury going to be when you're dealing with the doctor as a intervening actor? What's the injury? There's going to be something special about plaintiff's injury. You have to have both the underlying injury, right? So they come in unconscious, and then what happens? The doctor breaches with med mal, right? And now they're dead. Okay? So in the med mal scenario, the doctor's always going to exacerbate the injury. See it? So they're also a cause of plaintiff's ultimate injury. Or they come in and the doctor cuts off the wrong leg, so now they've exacerbated the injury. So see what you're always dealing with. Okay. Anyone tell me what the rule actually says about medical malpractice? Why can't you be assaulted as a doctor?
The foreseeable consequence that you'll screw up means it's not superseding.
We foresee doctors will malpractice all the time. It's completely foreseeable that they're going to malpractice. That seems a little insulting, right? Okay, so anyone want to work out why doctors should actually be very happy? Almost right. Is it that the doctor can't be held? So if we were to treat the doctor as super...
It's not the proximate cause or it's not the superseding issue or problem. Like, they're not going to be able to see that.
So if we say that malpractice is foreseeable, who's on the hook to the plaintiff?
Just that.
Both of them. Right? So when we say the malpractice is foreseeable, right, that means it's not superseding. So the injured plaintiff can sue both the doctor and the original drunk driver, right? Whereas if we labeled the doctor's conduct as superseding, who has to pay for the whole injury? The doctor. So although it's kind of insulting, the reason we have the rule is because we want the plaintiff to get back to the original wrongdoer that sends the victim to hospital. So see why it's a policy matter? We're going to flip it that way. Yes?
So the ultimate goal is really the apportionment or superseding or...
You could be that skeptical. So courts say that they're really asking either, is the intervening act foreseeable given the breach, or is the injury within the scope of the risk raised by the defendant? So courts will often say they're applying a principle. You might be skeptical and say, no, what they're really doing is deciding who has to pay and where you're going to draw the lines in actual policy.
So it's
To be honest with you, I think both are going on. Yes. Okay, let's do a couple. What should we do? Actually, let's complete the little sheet. We'll do the World Trade Center, and then we'll come back and do the hypos. Okay, so the analysis. See that little analysis section? Most of the time, the test we're going to run is to ask whether the intervening act is... In light of the risk created by defendants, if it is an unforeseeable intervening act, then it is superseding. It gets the super label, okay? So that's the way we're going to deal with intervening acts. I'm not claiming that most courts do that. I'm I'm not even claiming I like it. I'm just claiming that that's a way you can at least start to analyze. Okay, let's take a look at the World Trade Center case. And the first thing we need is someone has to give me the timeline. I don't want to give me who does what. So who's the original defendants that we're trying to get back against? Yep.
The manufacturers of the tablets or whatever.
So the chemical manufacturers. And what's the breach, or at least what's one of the two breaches?
That they didn't make them non-deadly.
Right, so they didn't add ingredients or process them so they're non-detonatable. A word you didn't utter before today. I think there's another set of A's in there. Okay, right, so that's their alleged breach, right? They should have made these chemicals in a form that decreased the ability of someone who got them to make them easily detonate. Okay, and who's the plaintiff? Right at the other end. Who's the plaintiff? The Port Authority. And what kind of injury did the Port Authority suffer?
Six dead,
but that's not what it's complaining about.
Property
damage. So there's extensive property damage to the World Trade Center, which is owned by the New Jersey Port Authority.
So the families of the six people could also file a claim against.
They could also file a claim, right? But this is actually the property damage claim. Okay, so the property damage claim from the terrorist explosion. Okay, so who is... Well, let's do a couple things. Do you think it's the wrong type of harm? So if you were representing the chemical manufacturers, would you argue it's the wrong type of harm? Or would you not? Would you pick that type of argument or not? So given their breach, what type of harm are we alleging and what type of harm materialized? So what was their breach?
They didn't make them happen.
So what's the foreseeable harm from that breach?
Bingo,
it's exactly the right type of harm. The reason we're complaining about, you didn't make it so it wouldn't explode. What happened? People used it to make an explosion. So notice type of harm is not a good argument here. How about risk over? Is there any argument that the risk they created was over? Right. So there's no risk over argument. So they have to come up with an intervening actor argument. Everybody see? And what do they come up with as the intervening actor? Who's the intervening actor? Terrorists. And where are they? Left the scene. Right. It's exactly the scenario we expect. Right? You can't get against the terrorists. We're trying to go back against the chemical manufacturers. Yep?
All right, I'm just a little confused. I understand their original complaints of that, but I thought there were many complaints that the Prills and Handles themselves were not explosive.
So you're right. One of the defenses, one of the arguments they raise.
So the plaintiff's amended complaint states that the Prills sold in their original form were not explosive.
They admit that what the defendants sell cannot by themselves explode. But their breach argument is that you should have made them so other people could make them into explosives. Does that make sense?
Isn't there some way that you can stop it right there, though? Because it just seems so ridiculous.
Okay, so.
I guess it just makes it unfair for them to say foreseeable that someone will alter your product, which we kind of say is where it stops, because what's the product made for itself, and if it's not detonable, or if it can't be explosive right there, then that's not a foreseeable risk yourself.
So your argument, so you want to argue what?
That it wasn't a foreseeable risk. The explosion when you sold the Pearl Forms.
So you want to say the doesn't even count as a brick. Right. So one argument, and notice the court makes it two different ways. They actually raise two different objections. What's the first objection? There's no duty. And that's your argument right here. So one of them make an argument that's like, hey, they don't have a duty to make it not exploitable. You can't even get a breach. They were selling perfectly great products. There's not even a duty to make it non-exploitable. And then the second type of argument is what? What other element do they fight over? Proximate cause. So they also make a proximate cause argument about whether it's there's an intervening action. So you're right. They make an argument right back in duty that says, we don't even think they breached a duty that was owed. And they also say, even if you did, there's a proximate cause problem. So let's play temporarily right here. Just looking at the common law rules, what you guess is going to happen? When you look at the intervening act, what is it?
Superseded.
Why?
Because it's a crime.
It's a crime, right? So when you're a betting woman and you look at it, you guess it's a crime. It's just not going to happen, right? So that's the argument. It's a crime. It looks as if we're likely to say it's superseded. So why do the plaintiffs argue, I know it's a crime, but it's foreseeable? The intervening act is foreseeable. What kind of evidence do the plaintiffs have, Mr. Huffman?
Like 50 years before and 30 years before, the products that they made were used for explosives. And like other countries had made them so that they had to be non-detonable to be sold. So they're arguing that it was foreseeable that they'd be using explosives, and they should have been making them.
Okay, so did everybody pick up those two bits of evidence? Other governments had ordered that you change the chemicals so that they couldn't be detonated, and you have a record of prior explosions where the chemicals were used to make bombs or simply cause an explosion. So why does the court say that's not enough? How does the court get around that? So what words does it emphasize? So did anyone find in proximate cause what test the court says it's running to? Because it doesn't say we know the cheat rule, crime equals unforeseeable. It doesn't do that. So instead, what test does it try and run to ascertain whether this intervening conduct breaks the causational chain?
Whether the foreseeable is subjective.
Oh, so that's a good phrase it uses. So anyone find how it actually, so we're going to go into foreseeability. How does it phrase the actual test? So if you look on 349, right? If you look on 348, because we're looking at proximate cause, right? It first on 348 describes the test as what? See those indented paragraphs? What does it do?
Logic, common sense, policy.
Right? Logic, common sense, policy. So it acknowledges that what courts are drawing lines based on logic, common sense, justice, and policy. Right? They're just drawing the line somewhere to limit liability. But on 349, it says when we go to draw the line, what does it think's key and what test does it use? So what does it say the key or critical criteria is when it goes to draw the line?
Whether any substantial alteration is the standard.
So what concept is it using under New York law? Anyone highlight anything on 349?
So the first thing they do is they say it's a matter of law for the court. They go, well, you might have thought proximate cause was a matter for the jury, but actually it's so clear here it's a matter for the court. Okay? But then court, good highlighting, you need a test. You need a pre-criteria. So what does it do under New York law?
Conceivability is not the equivalent of foreseeability.
So the test they want to run is?
Probable versus possible,
right? They don't want to say something's just conceivable. They want to argue if it's foreseeable, right? So if you look about halfway down the page, it says, is the district court recognized in New York as in New Jersey? Questions of whether an intervening act severs the chain of causation depends on the foreseeability of the intervening act, right? So the test they announce, the test we actually adopted, is the foreseeability of the intervening act. So why is it that this wasn't foreseeable? I mean, even the British could figure it out, right? So what does the court say? So different terms the court uses when it discusses whether this was foreseeable. So conceivable is one of them. Just because you can conceive of something doesn't mean it's foreseeable. Yep.
That a manufacturer is not liable for all uses that someone might put the product to. One of the examples they gave was somebody using a saw gun to cut short nails and cutting off his fingers.
Okay, so, but how do you know where that line is? So you're right, you're not liable for all
its
uses.
If it's used outside of its intended uses.
So intended is, so you're actually playing with a little bit of product liability, which we'll get to next semester. I'm more interested in the foreseeability role. So can people find definitions of foreseeability? So there are some in duty, there's some on 349. So why does the court think it's not foreseeable that terrorists are going to use this when we've got explosions? The Europeans and the British have worked it out. So one set of concept is conceivable is not the same as foreseeable. Anyone find any other descriptions of what reasonable foreseeability means? Yes. Okay, so clearly these are independent actors, right? If they were really employees of the defendant, then the defendant would be on the hook. But we have to, sometimes, even though the actors are, quote, other people, you still stay on the hook. So where else does the court describe reasonable foreseeability? You go back into duty, what do they describe? Yeah.
Objective foreseeability means reasonable foreseeability, and they said that the standard does not affix responsibility for future events that are only theoretically, remotely, or just possibly foreseeable.
So they're trying to draw some kind of distinction, right? Remember we discussed early on, that's why that reasonable word is in there. Objectively, reasonably foreseeable versus just a possibility, remote, right? Theoretical, we want to say it's reasonably foreseeable. Is it an objective or subjective test? Objective test, right? So the court repeats the limitations. Do you think it really isn't foreseeable? Really? It wasn't reasonably foreseeable? A show of hands. Who thinks it's reasonably foreseeable? Who thinks it's not? Okay, I guess the court had a majority vote.